thanks very much. This is a topic very dear to my heart. This is just, I mean, it's a small crowd, so please feel free to interrupt me or stop me at any point. I really want to make this just as useful for you as possible. And so I've just sort of been talking, watching a few of the previous lectures. Roger gave an awesome lecture last time. He'll be a hard act to follow. So if you learn a lot already about machine learning or ML, supervised and unsupervised learning. I think Mohammed touched on the Ising model. Classically, a lot of applications to many body physics and phases of matter. I think Roger mentioned superconductivity last time. So I want to sort of hopefully build on some of those ideas in the course and sort of maybe give them a quantum spin. So what is machine learning? Let's start off with the definition. There are sort of two definitions that people commonly use. One is just regular classical machine learning, ML, that uses quantum data, wave functions, for example, quantum probability distributions, and using classical ML to learn, say, when a phase transition occurs in a quantum system. So that's sort of still classical ML. The other definition is machine learning, but it's using basically swap a quantum, a classical computer for a quantum computer. So you've kind of got a quantum computer. And I should say, I'll give you all these lecture notes at the end. You can get all of them. So basically, yeah, swap out your classical regular computer for a quantum computer. And so you're kind of, in a way, just using quantum computer, actually, hopefully using the power of kind of quantum systems, and you're machine learning that away. And that's really the definition that we'll be using. Perhaps is the most interesting, at least it's the one we'll be focusing on today. So welcome. Again, feel free. So I'm Damien, guest lecturer. I'm going to be talking introduction to QML. Feel free to stop me at any point. It's a small crowd. I really want to make this useful. This is my first time giving this lecture. So yeah, this is the one we're going to focus on. Machine learning, but we're swapping our classical computer for a quantum computer. Of course, we've got to have some jargon, some acronyms. We've got regular ML that you've been using a lot in this course. And often quantum machine learning is just abbreviated as QML. So you see QML everywhere. Very, very high level summary of it. This is sort of one example maybe of sort of supervised machine learning, classical machine learning. Kind of really doesn't matter. The main thing is here, this is where we have the learning model. We have a classical computer. We sort of calculate a loss function. The important thing is we sort of feed that back into some kind of optimizer. We do some kind of classical optimization, change the weights in our model, and sort of repeat that cycle many, many times. So it's sort of a high level model of one type of just regular machine learning. And so what quantum machine learning is, you can think of it as you keep kind of the basic structure the same. So there's a lot that you keep. And pretty much I would say the only real change you make is you just take out your classical computer and then put a quantum computer here is what you're actually doing the learning on. So one important point is we don't completely throw away all our classical computers. And I think a better way to think of it is hybrid computation, where you've got a classical computer and a quantum computer hand in hand. So here is another sort of high level sort of explanation of it. And here you might have some quantum system, you're updating that, your quantum hardware, but the optimization basically is done. So you kind of have a quantum system, you kind of make a measurement outcome, you've got some results, got parameter values, and then you want to optimize those parameter values. And this is sort of vague at the moment, but I'll show you a very concrete example in a minute. And this optimization is done on a classical computer. And so it looks in many ways very, very similar, although there are some differences to what you kind of do in classical regular ML. And so this is sort of done here on a classical computer, some type of classical optimization typically. So I think maybe a better way would, like I said, hybrid computation. So why should you care about QML? So it's widely believed, though not proven, for some problems that QML is better than regular machine learning. So what do we mean by better? Faster, better mass asymptotic scaling. And also has many applications in many areas of physics. So not just in kind of quantum information. So for example, there are some cosmologists that are using one of the QML algorithms that we'll talk about, VQE, to basically simulate false vacuum decay, simulate some cosmological fields in the entire universe. So it potentially is a very, very useful tool. I mean, I don't know what areas of physics you have, but certainly people in high energy physics, as another field, are starting to use it, or at least starting to explore it. So one thing I do want to get across is that if it really does pan out, it will have applications. And just as ML is used in all sorts of areas across physics, maybe QML will be something that's outside of, say, traditional quantum information and have useful applications there. So it's a very exciting and rapidly growing field. And for those of you just at the forefront, the start of early days of your career in physics, it's just getting started. And I think there are many opportunities for young researchers to contribute and to really advance the field. Especially, I would say, if you're a physicist and you're good with either coding and data science, their interest for you, it really is sort of in many ways a cross-disciplinary subject. So it's if those two kind of fields sort of resonate with you, then there are a lot of opportunities at the moment. Maybe you're motivated by money. So last month, Google announced a $5 million prize for coming up with new quantum algorithms that can solve real world problems. You can find all the details about it there. $5 million global competition. So I don't know, maybe that's motivating in some ways. So really, I kind of see this really, hopefully, my goal is really just to kind of get you excited and interested and motivated about QML. And so I really see this as an invitation. And I'm going to be talking a lot to you today, but to me, kind of talking about QML is a bit like if I was trying to just explain soccer or football to you and I just talked about it, this is how you dribble, kick the ball, score a goal, you'd kind of learn something, but so I would say to really learn soccer, football, you've got to actually go out there and get a ball and kick it and actually do it. So I hope that I will motivate you. Mohammed has some great problems in the tutorial following this. So I hope that I will motivate you and get you interested enough that you can really kind of play around with some of the code. Because ultimately, we're talking about coding, computer programming, to kind of play around with it. Because I really feel that's kind of when you really kind of learn deeply about some of these topics. So I sort of invite you to do that. And I'm just going to be going through today two of very sort of popular quantum machine learning algorithms, variational quantum eigensolver and QAOA, quantum approximate optimization algorithm. So caution. So I'm glad you brought that up, Severin, before is these many people believe, for example, that VQE, variational quantum eigensolver, is better than the best classical algorithm that you have, but it's not proven yet. And we really don't know how much better quantum machine learning will be than classical machine learning. And you give a very smart computational physicist like Mohammed a very, very powerful high-performance computer coming up with a very sophisticated classical algorithm using classical machine learning, you can do a lot. And it's possible that they may be as good. I mean, no one has ruled out this possibility that they'll be as good as the best we can do with quantum. And they may be, you know, equal to the best you can do with quantum machine learning. So there's still some sort of gray, I would say, about this area. And we just don't know just how big or small QML be. So I would just, I don't know, sort of put that as a caution. So to me, that's sort of very exciting. I'm sort of a glass half full person. There's a lot to explore. And even if it does pan out, I think we'll learn a lot about quantum systems, their behavior, something very, very deep about that. So there's either way, there's very sort of exciting things ahead. So what's an example? I think I can talk about it. I think the best thing is to give you a concrete example. Yeah, so VQE variational quantum eigensolver from 2014. We have a quantum system and you'd like to know its ground state, what's the lowest energy state. In many cases, you've got a complicated quantum system, a complicated molecule. That's not very easy to find out. It's a very non-trivial problem. Why might you care about calculating the ground state of some quantum system? Often it's the first step in calculating the electronic properties of the system. So its conductivity, chemical reactions, pathways. It's something that many body physicists, at least, are very, very interested in. So it's a very well-motivated problem. So steps in VQE. So what do you do? First of all, you kind of parameterize the quantum state of interest. If you've got, say, a qubit, you might, if you kind of think of the Bloch sphere, you could, for example, get the two angles that parameterize where a pure state is on the Bloch sphere. You take an educated guess or ansatz. Have they come across ansatz before? Okay, yeah, an ansatz. For what you think, initial guess for what the ground state is. And then you calculate the energy of the initial guess. On a quantum computer, because this is a quantum state, you're looking at the ground state of a quantum system, and that's done on a quantum computer. And then you just kind of take your guess and calculate a better guess, basically by a classical optimization procedure. And it's important to note is often, generally, this is done on a classical computer, hence why it's hybrid computation. You get a better guess for the parameters, you calculate the energy with your new state, with your better parameters, and you essentially just kind of keep repeating, getting hopefully better and better guesses until basically the guess you get for the energy stops changing, settles down. Fingers crossed you have got the ground state of your system. So this is sort of a high level, this is kind of vague. This is sort of a visualization of it. I find certainly it's most useful if you kind of give a concrete example. So let's say you have just a spin half particle here, and we just apply an external magnetic field. So it's just a classical magnetic field. We're not doing anything fancy. We're treating it classically. Let's say it's a very strong magnetic field. And it's sort of directed down, so parallel to the x-axis. So and sort of the analogous kind of classical system would just be a little bar magnet. And if you just get a bar magnet and you kind of just let it, you know, freely rotate, eventually, as you know, it will sort of line up with Earth's magnetic field here. So we'll see this settle down now. And that's sort of the lowest energy state parallel to the field. And this is sort of, I would say, a loose analogy for what's happening. We've got it settled there, so the Earth's magnetic field is going parallel to the magnet there. And so you kind of get an analogous thing in quantum. So the ground state is basically when your qubit, your spin half system, is sort of pointing parallel to the magnetic field you have. So we might think of this as one way we can kind of parameterize a spin half particle. I'm trying to keep things simple. We have sort of real amplitudes there for the qubit. We're not worrying about any kind of complex amplitudes. And here is just one way we can think of. There's a whole kind of family of kind of parameters here, of states here that you could have as we vary theta, if you're kind of familiar with the Bloch sphere, we go everywhere from the North Pole, the top of the Bloch sphere, way down to the South Pole, sort of in the XZ plane. So these are all sort of a whole family of states. There's a lot of possibilities here. So this is just one simple way of parameterizing a spin half particle. And so you could say the problem, which state minimizes H or the expectation value of H, the expectation value of the energy or the Hamiltonian of that particle. And so this is kind of overkill for using VQE, but we just want to give a toy problem. So here, well, we start with the Hamiltonian, which is given by minus B, the magnetic field strength, multiplied with Z there, Z, Pauli operator, or if you prefer sigma Z. I'm probably just going to be using Z throughout the rest of the lecture, but in any case, it's given by this matrix here, Pauli Z operator. And so this is the Hamiltonian we have for the system. This is what we want to minimize the expectation value of. And the answer is, in this case, just the spin down. state. It's basically where the spin of the particle, again, is parallel to the magnetic field, kind of in analogy to the classical situation. So that's the answer. You can also find the answer, again, this is overkill, but a toy problem, via VQE, if you so chose. So what is it? Let's go through the steps we saw before, but in a concrete way. First of all, you kind of parameterize a whole family of quantum states, here just with this one angle parameter theta. Then we take an educated guess. We're just kind of, in this case, just kind of take a guess for what the ground state is. And now let's try theta over 2. Let's just kind of guess something. And so in that case, the initial state we have just turns out to be an equal superposition of spin up and spin down. Again, if you kind of think of it on the Bloch sphere, that's just on the equator on the Bloch sphere. So that's sort of the guess. It's not a bad guess. It's not a great guess. That's where we're starting. And then we just take that state, and then basically we kind of calculate the grounds, the energy for that state. And so to do that, I mean, we're trying to find the ground state of a qubit. It's a quantum system. So this is why where we need to use a quantum computer. So what we do is we need to sort of prepare the spin half particle or qubit in that initial state. So here is where physically we're talking about a spin half particle, but typically we do this on a quantum computer. So there, as you know, there are many, many different types of quantum computers. Some use physical spin half particles, some use other quantum systems. And so typically what's done is we sort of map the spin half particle to the zero and one states of whatever physical quantum computer you have, whether it's a superconducting, it's an ion trap quantum computer. And so this is not the only way, but the conventional mapping, perhaps it's a bit confusing, is just to sort of map the spin up state to the zero state, spin down state to the zero state. If you kind of think of sort of the Bloch sphere, kind of the North Pole, I'm putting the South Pole there. That makes sense. That's kind of the mapping I'm using there, which is, I'd say, the most common. So how do we actually do this? If we're thinking of actually doing this on a quantum computer, typically, again, quantum computers really prepare by default qubits really in the zero state. So we start with a quantum computer in the zero state, and then to get it, for example, to the initial state here, this is sort of the psi zero, the initial guess, we just need to kind of rotate it around by an angle of pi over 2. And so we just apply a rotation operator. It's a quantum gate. This is a matrix that implements it. It's just a one qubit gate, so it's something very easy to do on a quantum computer. And then so you basically prepare that state. And then you really calculate, you want to find the expectation value of H. So we just measure the energy of that state. In this case, it's quite easy. It's actually proportional to the Pauli Z operator. So by just measuring that qubit after we prepared the state in the Z basis, the computational basis, if we do that once, we'll get one value. We want to find the average value. So we repeat that a number of times, 100 times, whatever. And then after that time doing that, we average up all the results. In this case, average up all the results, the average value we get for the expectation value of Z, and it's pretty, it's proportional to the expectation value of H. So after we take the average, after sampling the quantum computer many times, you end up with the result. In this case, it turns out to be zero. Zero is what you get if you have a noiseless quantum computer. So we've got our result. It's not the ground state. It's not the perfect state. It's not a bad guess. And then we want to optimize that. And so one way of doing that, and this is, I'm going to say this part, basically it's the same as what I'm guessing you've seen before. It's just the same thing that's done, in this case, at least to classical regular ML. You calculate just the gradient. We're just going to do simple gradient descent. calculate what the gradient is of expectation value of h with theta, and then use that basically to kind of basically sort of, you can see where the value of h is increasing, and you want to go the opposite direction of that, kind of decreasing, so to speak, downhill. And then you just get a new value by multiplying the negative of the gradient by some kind of step size here. Sometimes it's called the learning rate. I think you've come across that in your lectures before. And then you get a new value for the parameter, which is a better value. It's got a lower sort of energy or expectation value of the energy. And this is just vanilla gradient descent. So then we've got our new state, we've got our new parameter value. We sort of repeat the process. We start with the qubit in, say, the zero state, but in this case, we rotate it by a different angle. And probably the angle is going to be a little bit down here. So this is sort of our second guess. We, again, prepare the state from the zero state. And essentially, we kind of repeat that process. And what we're going to be doing visually is just a series of arrows that get closer and closer to the south pole, kind of the one state, the ground energy state. And essentially, that's how VQE works. That's sort of the intuition behind it. I always like to remind myself that VQ is it's a computational algorithm. It's performed on computers, both classical and quantum computers. And so you've got to program those computers. You, the quantum operator, has to. And so QML typically is done in libraries. Most of them are Python. There are a few C++ libraries around. But the most commonly used ones, at least today, kind of in Python. These are two, I would say, the most popular ones at the moment, Penny Lane and Qiskit. The tutorial that you'll see from Mohammed later on today involves Penny Lane, but there's sort of a lot of overlap between that and other kind of common QML libraries. And so I think it'll kind of give you just a flavor, a sense of what they're all about. But certainly, you know, if you have some experience programming in Python, they're sort of a very natural extension of this. You're very used to using additional libraries, Pandas, SciPy, etc. They're just extra libraries, which admittedly some kind of, at least to a classical person, some of the commands are somewhat counterintuitive. But I can talk about it for hours, but I think kind of when you play around with it, that's when I think most people really learn about this. If we were to sort of graph what we have in this case, this we start here, pi over 2, which I, oh, yes.
Well, I had a question about VQE and what step specifically in this chain is not, you know, is difficult in a classical computer?
So the difficult thing is, it's a great question. I would say step three. So you may be saying, well, we're talking about a qubit. I can simulate a qubit on a classical computer in my sleep. And so the thing is the scaling. So generally, let's say we scale this up and we have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, we get more and more qubits, generally speaking, to the Hilbert space increases exponentially. And generally speaking, we require sort of exponential classical computational resources as we scale up the number of qubits. And so the scaling, as we increase the number of qubits, gets harder and harder, supposedly exponential scaling for a classical computer. Great question. Thank you. And so this is, you can kind of see here, we start here sort of on the equator, and we just basically decrease the energy going down as we change our parameter value, and we end up at pi here. This is sort of the ground state around about minus sort of 2. So, and you can see the slope is getting shallower and shallower, and we kind of end up here. So hopefully it's kind of given you a sort of a concrete sense for what VQE is. Obviously, this is a toy problem. It's kind of overkill. But I really wanted to give you kind of just something kind of concrete. Does that make sense? OK, good. Of course, you have to say yes. applications. So I think Mom had showed you quite a bit about the Ising model, the classical Ising model, I believe. So there's also something, did you do the quantum Ising model as well, or just? classicalizing model, generally you've got a spin chain, but there you've just got two each spin can be just classically up or down. The quantumizing model is basically just replace all of the classical spins by qubits. So now instead of just being up or down, the binary option, they can be anywhere, for a pure state at least, along the block sphere here. So you're adding to the complexity. You're just changing your bits for qubits. I should say, if you are interested, the tutorial, there's the code for actually how you do this in Penny Lane. And you can kind of see just really how this is actually done. And pretty much, I think all the examples here in the tutorial, there's sort of code for you to play around with and look at. This is, again, typically a lot of different physicists, many body physicists are interested maybe in the quantumizing model, maybe looking for phase change. There's a lot of cool, Roger talked about emergence. There's a lot of cool emergent behavior in the quantumizing model. It's also even something that cosmologists are using to study quantum fields in the entire universe, interestingly enough. So this is one of the applications people use VQE for. Ground states of molecules, people, that's another big application. You've got very, very complex molecule. Let's say you're trying to design a new drug. It would be very helpful if you knew what the ground state of that is. You could find out, you could actually learn a lot about the properties of molecules from its ground state. So that's a really big application of VQE. The tutorial code goes through an example, probably the simplest molecule you can imagine, just H2, two hydrogen atoms. You can find the ground state of that to kind of give you a little bit of a flavor. And the other thing, people, potentially VQE actually could be used for helping to model some of the reactions, chemical reactions that will really improve the efficiency of carbon capture. It's something we can do, but people are trying to see which enzymes will basically increase the efficiency, make it a better process. They're kind of crazy complicated molecules in chemical reaction pathways and chains and carbon capture. And now people are just really experimenting in the lab, just, you know, beakers and test tubes, and trying different enzymes, different catalysts that will speed up that reaction, make carbon capture better, help save the planet. And the potential, maybe if things pan out, the pipe dream, would be to actually, instead of doing those, you know, messy kind of chemical reactions with the lab coats and the test tubes, is actually simulating them all on a quantum computer, or simulating certain properties of them, and maybe modeling and helping improve carbon capture. Although I would say that's a fair ways off. So I talked about using sort of gradient descent. There are many, many different ways that you can optimize. There's just a few of them there. I don't really want to kind of get into the details, but there are just many different choices that you have. And often different, again, I kind of think of it as tools. Sometimes you want to use a hammer. Sometimes you want to use a screwdriver. These are just different tools you can use depending on what problem you have. If you have very issues with local minima, et cetera. So it's just good to be aware. I just really want to make you aware there are a lot of different ways to optimize, to do this classical optimization. And these are just different tools you can apply to different problems that are more or less useful in different cases. What's the intuition for why VQE might be better or more useful? To your question, the classical computing overhead seems to increase exponentially as you get more and more qubits, but only sort of polynomial if we're using VQE, using really a quantum system to simulate some other quantum system. And so there is where the believed kind of advantage, computational advantage is. The other thing to note is it's a variational algorithm. You kind of got a parameter, you're varying it, you're finding out what the optimal parameter is by changing it a little bit. And many QML algorithms actually are, I would say most of them are actually variational algorithms. So that's a very common thread that you kind of see throughout a lot of these. So that is kind of VQE. So QAOA. So quantum approximation optimization algorithm. Bit of a mouthful, QAOA. What problem does it solve? So this is another very common QML algorithm. So let's look at an example. So I think in lecture 6, you saw the classicalizing model. So your spin chain. So each of these are just classical spins. They can either be pointing up or down, north or south. You've got n of them here. I guess I'm just going to try and keep it simple. We've just got a one-dimensional, no two-dimensional or three-dimensional, n spins. Each one can be up or down. And also, we can have a local magnetic field applied to the ith spin. So there could be here a magnetic field maybe pointing up, maybe pointing down. And that could be different for each of the n spins that we have there. Just going to look at nearest neighbor interactions. So these kind of two spins talk to each other, these two, et cetera, as we go along. So this model, people have studied a lot classically and quantum mechanically. Here, it's kind of going to go back to classical. And here, even though we're going to be looking at the classical Ising model for reasons which hopefully will become apparent in a minute. So what's the ground state of that? So I give you some 1D classical Ising model. What's the ground state of that? What's the energy of the ground state? On the surface, you think of it, you've got n spins. Each one could be up or down. So there's 2 to the n possible different combinations of the spins. So the possible number of configuration scales increases exponentially. So at first blush, this is sort of a non-trivial problem to solve, I hope to convince you of. So you can actually solve that on a quantum computer. So it's kind of strange, maybe a bit counterintuitive, solving a classical problem by mapping it to a quantum computer, but bear with me. So the important thing to note is you can think of this as a combinatorial optimization problem. So there are different combinations of the spins being up or down. And the problem of finding the ground state and the ground state configuration, if you say Zi is the spin of the ith particle, what you can just get is here, again, just thinking classically, you can get an expression for the energy. The most important thing here is you've got two terms in the classical energy. Really, you've got a term here from just the nearest neighbor interaction between the spins, whether they're really aligned parallel or anti-parallel. They're the only two real possibilities. And then an energy associated with the interaction of the ith spin with the kind of basically the local magnetic field that it has. So these are the possibilities. So you've got all of these sort of Zs here. And these are, again, these are just 1 or minus 1. These are just sort of spin up or spin down. That's the mapping that we're going to be using. So we're sort of forgetting about quantum mechanics for the moment. This is just kind of a real number here. And J is just the interaction strength between nearest neighbors. In principle, we could solve that by something called adiabatic quantum computation. What is that? Well, you start with n qubits. So we're really trying to model n bits with n qubits. And what you do is you take each of the classical bits, each of the spins, and you encode that in the state of a qubit. So basically, if you've got a classical spin that's up there, you encode that state of your quantum bit, quantum spin being spin up, classical spin down, encode that state of the quantum spin down. Again, this might seem like it's overkill, but certainly we could do that. There are many more possible states, but a quantum system being a lot richer than a classical system can actually do that mapping, can really, of course, I think intuitively a quantum bit can simulate one classical bit. And then what we do is we sort of take the classical energy expression, we have the classical Hamiltonian, map that exactly to a quantum Hamiltonian. So essentially, you just take the classical Hamiltonian, put hats on everything to represent quantum operators. And now we've got a quantumizing model. We've got this mapping from classical to quantum. The form of the energy expressions, the Hamiltonians, is exactly the same. And now we want to minimize then the case what happens if we minimize this quantum energy that will give us an energy value, some quantum states, and that will map back to a ground state classically, and then ground state configuration for the classicalizing model. So this is what we do. So all we need to do, simple, is just find the ground state of this quantum Hamiltonian. Simple. Well, not so simple. It's a non-trivial thing, but in principle, what we could do this by is something called adiabatic quantum computation. So how does this work? So what we could do adiabatic here means basically very, very slowly. So what we could is we could start the system in the ground state of what I'm calling a very simple Hamiltonian, or something that's very simple to prepare on a quantum computer. And so you start, and then you very, very, very slowly kind of almost sort of turn a knob, if you imagine, and change that Hamiltonian to the Hamiltonian you're interested in, the Ising model. And then what should happen if you do that slowly enough, we know, you can prove that we kind of prepare this ground state of a very simple Hamiltonian, just slowly change and tweak your Hamiltonian over a long period of time to the Hamiltonian of the Ising model, which is much, much more complicated, much, much richer. And if you do that slowly enough, then you're not perturbing the system out of the ground state, and then the system stays in that. And so after this process, you actually have the system is in the ground state of the Ising model Hamiltonian, H Ising, that you want. And lo and behold, you just need to measure the energy, measure what the configuration is, and you have solved the problem. Maybe not a really intuitive way of solving a problem, but in principle, you could do this. Some experimentalists do something like this, but to do it purely could take a very, very long time, because depending on the Hamiltonian you want to find the ground state of, you could take require a long time to do this, maybe just prohibitively too long a time. So the other thing I'll just mention is this is essentially what mathematically what adiabatic quantum computation does, is you just, again, if you imagine an experimental lab, you just kind of slowly change your Hamiltonian. You start off with a lot of your H simple, none of your H Ising, and you just slowly kind of adjust the rates of that until you end up with just at time capital T, just the H Ising Hamiltonian. So theoretically possible, hard to do in practice. And so OQAOA is just an approximation, this ideal approach that's less resource intensive. So what do we do? We just, conventionally, the simple Hamiltonian, it's something that's it's simple. By simple, we just mean something that's easy for a quantum computer to prepare. It's just a sum of all the Pauli X operators. That's a matrix for the Pauli X, sigma X operators, whatever kind of language you want to use. And we just start the system in the ground state of that. And then we just want to simulate, somehow approximate this sort of ideal evolution where we go from a lot of the simple Hamiltonian, none of the complex Ising Hamiltonian, and just adjust the parameters until they swap. But how do we do this? So this is a ground state. If you actually do the calculation, you can find out this is a ground state. If we have, again, we're thinking of a quantum computer, this is just sort of n qubits. What we have is just an equal superposition of all possible bit strings here is the ground state of our simple Hamiltonian. And then we've got this time evolution from zero to capital T. What we do is we just break that up into a lot of very small time segments. So we just kind of carve up the time into a bunch of very, very, very small time segments here. And then we just look at one of those. So instead of ideally, we just smoothly vary the coefficient of the Ising Hamiltonian. We linearly just increase that over time. What we do is we just basically take each of the time segments and just have a constant coefficient in each case. And so instead of smoothly going up, from the simple Hamiltonian to the Ising Hamiltonian, we just go up in a bunch of discrete jumps or steps. And we do a lot of them over a very small amount of time. And that's, you know, that approximates this ideal evolution. And so here, within each of these little chunks of time, the Hamiltonian has this form here, where here Tm is just some time that represents the mth time interval that we have. That looks kind of complicated and messy, but if you actually sort of look at that, in essence, it's of this form here. It's sort of exponent of a plus b multiplied by delta t. And the important thing is here, because we're keeping this constant throughout each time interval, what we have is the A and B, these are time-independent Hamiltonians. We're just approximating a constant Hamiltonian in this little kind of chunk of time. So if these were just regular algebra, these were not fancy quantum operators, we could actually just say, well, you know, you can just use a algebraic rule there, and that's equal just to the product of these two. But unfortunately, because these are messy, complex mathematical objects, they don't commute with each other, you just can't use this simple rule that you might just use for C numbers. So it is known that you can actually, a good approximation to kind of a Hamiltonian of this form or just an exponent of this form, basically, if you kind of, again, divide up this time interval into sort of n small, even smaller time intervals, and you just do a sort of product of the exponents, and you repeat that n times, as your delta t here gets very, very small, and your n gets very, very large in the limit, that actually kind of approaches a very good approximation to this more complex Hamiltonian here with sort of the sum there in the exponent. Now, I wish I could give you a simple derivation of that. I'm not aware of everything simple. You can find it, you can Google, it's the Lee-Trotter formula. I don't want to kind of put you all asleep with sort of a derivation, but I'm going to just assert that this is true for the moment. And I'm hoping that you look at the left-hand side here and the right-hand side, and that doesn't look like completely crazy. Does that, could you buy that maybe that is kind of a reasonable approximation? Okay, I see at least one person nodding their heads, so good. Okay, so this is what we have. So we basically, if you turn that into a recipe, and we're sort of leading up to coding, maybe you might kind of think about pseudocode. So essentially what we do is we apply that, to really simulate this Hamiltonian, we apply the Ising model Hamiltonian for a very short amount of time, then the simple Hamiltonian, and then we just repeat that process many, many times, n times, where n is pretty large. And that is how, in practice, we would sort of implement sort of this approximation formula here. So that's kind of what instructions you would do in code or an actual quantum computer would perform. So hopefully that makes sense. But now we've figured out what we do in each one small time interval. We've got a lot of those. So we just do exactly the same thing we had in the previous slide, but we do that in all uppercase M time intervals we have across the whole kind of time range from 0 to T. So it's kind of complicated here, but it's like we break up. We've got 0 over here. We've got capital T. We sort of break up the whole time interval into M time intervals, smaller time intervals. We have a a constant Hamiltonian within each of these little intervals. And then within each of those intervals, oh, thank you, we break up the time interval again. And in orange, what that allows us to do is to get an approximation of get an approximation of this exponent with a sum here in the exponent. And so we just sort of repeat that process for each of these. And so basically, effectively, what we're doing is that's how we build it up. Effectively, what it looks like if you draw to kind of the circuit diagram, you're just implementing for a very short period of time the Ising model Hamiltonian, then your simple Hamiltonian, then Ising model, simple, Ising, simple, Ising, simple. And you're just repeating that many, many, many times. So you're just swapping back and forth between implementing each of those Hamiltonians on your quantum computer for very short amounts of times. You do that a lot, and that's a decent, hopefully a decent approximation to the full adiabatic quantum computation. So let's say we do that. At the end, we've got to measure something. What we have, we measure each qubit in the computational basis. We're going to get a bit stream. So if we just, again, simple case, if we have, say, three qubits in this case, we might measure 0, 1, 0. And now, remember, we had a mapping between our sort of qubits and our classical bits in the classicalizing model. This represents one or up, down, up. And so in this case, this would be the solution that the QAOA would give for the ground state. In this case, spin up, spin down, spin up. So that's the solution we have, or at least part of it. So if we do the full QAOA in all its glory, we kind of start sort of in the ground state of sort of a sort of spin X, Pauli X operator here. And then we, what QAOA does, it initially starts off is, you might kind of wonder, the only thing I guess I really haven't specified is in each of these two little, these little steps of times, you may ask me, well, what is N, what is M? How small is kind of the time interval here that we want to basically simulate each Hamiltonian for? So what QAOA has said, instead of trying to figure out what it is, because this is machine learning, basically it tries to learn what the optima values for each of these little time intervals are here, all the way up to here. So initially, you just kind of pick random time intervals. You just start it. That's your ansatz, or the initial parameter values. You kind of pick sort of random times for all of the little time windows that you want to apply each of the Hamiltonians for. And then you run the algorithm. Then you measure in the computational basis, the Z basis. You're going to get some bit string, 0, 1, 0, whatever it is. And then, but well, you know, this is quantum physics. So typically you get really a probability distribution of outcomes. So you just repeat steps 1 to 3 a bunch of times. And what that is going to give you a nice histogram, a nice sort of probability distribution for all of the outcomes. So maybe 20% of the time you measure spin up, spin up, spin up. 50% spin up, spin down, spin up. And then 30% spin down, spin down, spin down. You're going to get really just a histogram, a bar chart of all possible outcomes. Then you just kind of go back here. Then you need to calculate what the H value, or the energy value, is for each of those. How do you do that? So if we go way back here, what the QAOA has given us is all of these values for Z, these Zi, and these are just going to be numbers we can just say are just going to be +1 or -1. We just plug them into the formula here. And then just here, this is just sort of just calculating a classical function here. We just use this formula, calculate what our the energy is for that guess of the algorithm. And then we find out what the lowest value, the least value of H that we've got, whether it's -2, -3, whatever it is. And that's really the output of the algorithm, or at least one run of it. So we do that, we take a deep breath, and then we finish off the algorithm. So we've kind of really run it once. We just randomly chose the parameter values, like how long or short all of these times we're going to be here for all of these little time values. Then this is where the machine learning part comes in. Then we take a classical computer, we classically optimize and find out better values for all of the p parameter, all of the 2p parameter values, all of the possible time durations, and then run the whole thing again. Basically go back and run, instead of random times, basically kind of go back here, run step, prepare the ground state again, apply these, measure in the comp in the Z basis, measure a bunch of times, calculate the lowest classical energy value. Hopefully it is better, lower than before. And we just keep repeating 1 to 6 until either the result stops changing or we're confident enough that we have a good enough approximation to the ground state. And that's QAOA and how that works. So again, there's a couple of code examples in the tutorial. Certainly I find I really need to kind of play around with it and explore things to kind of get an idea. So here's sort of one way you can kind of visualize it. This is sort of the full circuit. Again, it's a variation algorithm. At the end of the day, we get a sample, a probability distribution sample, out where we get the lowest value of H, the classical energy, and then just sort of optimize the classical value of energy by updating these parameters, which are really time durations that we run the algorithm for. So just to finish up sort of a toy example, maybe just keep it simple. We have 2 spins. We have no local magnetic fields. Here, there's just 4 configurations. Spin 1 can be up or down. Classicalizing model spin 2 can be up or down. If we think of it, if we just apply, in this case, the simple Hamiltonian, what we have here after applying just the first thing that we do, the initial state for QAOA, if we were to calculate, sample the distribution, what we would find is here, each of the qubit is say, along this equator of the block sphere. It's an equal probability or equal superposition of being up and down. So each of the 4 possible bit strings, 00, 01, 10, 11, they're just kind of equally possible, equally likely. So that's essentially what we have. It's not really informative. All the possible outcomes are equally likely. After we apply QAOA, basically, in this case, it's just each of those simple Hamiltonians, an Ising Hamiltonian, once. What we end up, the result of that is, if you were to sample the probability distribution, we get this. So the important thing about this is that these are much, much more likely here. And that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. Because if you think of the mapping that we have, these are qubit results. And 00 maps to spin up, spin up. 11 maps to spin down, spin down. And if we calculate the energies using the classical Ising model Hamiltonian, we get the energies of -1 and -1, which is actually the ground state. So here, what we have after just doing a very simple toy version of VQE, what we end up with is not exactly in the ground state, but the most likely outcomes are the 2 classical states that do correspond to the ground state. So that's a good thing. So that's, oh, I should say, this is just 1 optimization iteration. Let's try it a bit more. If we do 5, then you see, just note how high these kind of bumps are here, these bars. If we do 5 optimization iterations, they go down lower. The answers that we want, the correct answers, go up a bit higher. That's a good thing. It's important to note that generally these don't go down to nothing, so it's a probabilistic outcome algorithm. It's not sort of guaranteed 100% of the time to give you the correct result, but it's still decent. For 20 optimizations, so notice how small these are, these go down to almost 0 now. So again, we're running the algorithm more and more, and what we're finding is the ground state configurations are becoming more and more likely. So it's doing a better job of finding the ground state of the classicalizing model using a quantum algorithm and a quantum computer. Any questions? Yes.
You're approximating a continuous function by steps, and you're approximating non-commuting matrices by basically using a trotterization.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
So you've got these two approximations going on a lot of the time.
Yes.
Why are your approximations not getting worse results rather than better results?
So you're saying given the number and the quality of the approximations, you would expect it...
Why doesn't the error add up to more and more error?
So that's a good question. I would say so. Yeah, that's a good question. Part of it, I would say, So there are some errors in practice. I think part of it is here. This result is in the limit here. So if you take this is really a limit. So in the limit of n approaches infinity, this sort of becomes an exact result. Obviously, you're not going to get there in practice. And so you can kind of, one way you can keep your errors down is just by the approximation gets better and better as you make these delta t's smaller and smaller, and you repeat these two exponents, these Hamiltonians, more and more times. So that's one way you can kind of control and keep your errors down.
And they are at one step. You're also doing lots of steps.
That's true. Yeah. So there are also better higher order approximations in this that people sometimes use that are a bit more sophisticated than this to kind of keep the error down. That's another way. But I guess it's not obvious why, if you just do something a lot of times, the smaller error, why doesn't the error just blow up? I think that's your question. Yeah, I think part of the answer to that is you're keeping a lid on the error by basically keeping these time steps very, very small. That would be, I'd say, the main one, and also using a more sophisticated formula than this to approximate it. There definitely are errors, but I would say that's the two main ways. And probably, if I thought about it more, you could probably get an upper bound in what the error is, which maybe you would be interested in. Maybe I could think about that some more. Does that?
Yeah.
Okay, but thank you for that. This is sort of a way of sort of visualizing it, doing this whole messy procedure many, many times, many, many iterations, and that's what it is. Okay, so just to finish up, we've got sort of the toy example. So it's something that resources scales polynomially, I kind of want to sort of end on. So this actually has many, you say, well, why should I care about this? You know, the Ising model is very exciting, but you know, there's more to life than the Ising model. It turns out many real world problems are a COP, or combinatorial optimization problems. There are many people in finance, portfolio optimization in stocks, logistics, if you're an Amazon trying to figure out the most efficient way to deliver packages, chemistry, material science, many body physics, as we just saw, there are a lot of problems both inside and outside of physics that you can actually map to a combinatorial optimization problem. And QAOA is just a tool for solving combinatorial optimization problems. And so one of the reasons it's really driving these interest is it seems like it's a very, very versatile tool, maybe kind of like a Swiss Army knife of quantum computing. What's the performance of QAOA versus the best classical algorithms? We don't know yet. It does depend on the problem. There's some preliminary evidence that it's better than for certain particular problems, but these are not proven results yet. So there's definitely a question mark. The other thing is a lot of these algorithms, the amount of the circuit depth you need, the amount of operations you need to perform on each qubit is pretty low. There's sort of a low circuit depth. These are fairly shallow algorithms. And so one of the reasons it's driving this is obviously we don't have perfect big quantum computers now. The quantum computers we have are small. They're quite noisy. These are actually quite nice algorithms for running on sort of noisy quantum computers. And there's a hope that may or may not pan out in that in today's quantum computers of the next few years, we'll be able to actually run these algorithms and do some interesting things. You can run toy versions of these algorithms now, but pretty much everything you can do, you can just do on a classical computer. So it'd be really cool if we got to the stage where the best you could do on a quantum computer, say for finding the ground state of a molecule, on a quantum computer is better than the best you can do on the world's best supercomputer using the best classical algorithm that we have. That's a hope, a dream. We're not there yet. So I hope, my main goal was to motivate you. And I hope when I look around the room, I see some interested faces. No one has fallen asleep. That's a good sign. These are just some cool references I like. There's a really cool 41 lecture YouTube series on QML. Just a random sample of some other resources. But I really just want to end on this, some big questions. You're all young researchers. You're active, starting your career. So what are some of the big questions? So some of the big questions, how much better? If you found the how much better actually are, can we prove the QAOA and VQAR and the best classical algorithms? And it's possible there the answer might be that they're not actually any better. That would be a pessimistic result, but I think we do need to be open to that. We just need to figure out what the answer to that question is. And what other quantum algorithms exist? Sometimes I've heard some quantum QML researchers saying that these QML algorithms that we have are almost like baby algorithms. These are the algorithms that if you were kind of thinking classically, you'd come up with as the first QML algorithms, as sophisticated as they are. So if we could get someone, if you could think more quantum mechanically, more quantumly, what other QML algorithms you could come up with, whatever it means to think quantumly. We don't know. That's a big question. And also, what QML algorithms, what problems can they solve? Because ultimately, in many ways, I mean, you can be interested in QML for just the foundational aspect, but many people, perhaps the majority, just want to use it as a tool. It's a tool for solving problems. And so what are the physics problems, particularly in many body physics, and what are the real world problems can it actually solve? We don't know. They're open questions. So there's a lot. I think we're just getting started in what is a very exciting field. Thank you for your time.